Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka. Conversations plus connections equals community. Those are my three C's. The heart of my show is, what's your story? It's my belief we all have stories. Some are similar, others are uniquely different. Storytelling brings the passions of my guests to life through our conversations. So be prepared to be entertained, informed, and inspired. Welcome to today's show. Well, good afternoon, everybody, and you're in for, I think, what I consider to be a very inspiring story with my guest, Diane Jones. She is an award-winning children's book author and, honestly, so much more. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Thank you so much, Marcia. I really appreciate you having me.
Oh, it's so cool. And, you know, you and I have spoke off the air because I like to talk to my guests ahead of time. And it's always interesting when somebody doesn't live anywhere near you and you find that you have a mutual connection. So, but I thought, and that just may come out in our conversation. But before we get into your topics, I always think it's really great to get to know my guests. So could you just please tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I grew up in Boxborough, Massachusetts, which is a very small rural town about 20 miles west of Boston. And it just was a great place to grow up. There was like lots of space. The yards were big and there were woods around and plenty of children, you know, in and around my age. So you always had somebody to play with and it just felt safe. The roads didn't get much traffic. And so we were always, you know, doing all kinds of fun things like climbing trees and building forts and riding, racing usually our bikes down the streets. And so it was a really nice childhood from the standpoint of just having kids around and having space to do kids stuff.
Yes.
And one of the cool things was that there were several farms that were nearby, and my mother became friendly with one of the owners of the farms in particular, and anytime a little calf was going to be born at his farm, he would call my mom and say, do you want to bring the kids down to see the calf be born? And so it was always this big treat to go down there and see the little baby calf be born. And I was just born with this like innate love of nature and animals. And so, you know, for me, that was like, you know, just the best thing ever. So I have fond memories in terms of where I grew up. Horses actually came into my life early. One of my closest friends in grade school had a very ornery pony, and ponies actually have that rap of being somewhat ornery. And in spite of him being ornery, we still loved him, and we played with him every chance we got, probably much to his chagrin. I'm sure he wished these two little kids would just leave him alone, and he did his best to dissuade us, but we kept coming back, you know, for more. So I then ended up graduating, you know, from high school and went on to the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, where I got a marketing degree, Bachelor's of Marketing. And after college, I moved to Southern Maine. And the thing I found out was that it was difficult to go to work in marketing in that location. There just were very, very few jobs. And so I ended up doing a short stint in the restaurant business. I feel like many people have.
Yes.
You do it in college or something. Mine lasted a little bit longer than that. Before I made the leap into financial services in 1994. So that's when I got into financial services, and I had really an amazing career, 28 years long, very rewarding and successful. It recently came to a natural close for me, And I say natural clothes because it just kind of was, I'm in my 50s and I've done it for 28 years and I feel so grateful for everything that came to me as a result of my career, both in terms of skills and these wonderful, like, lifelong friends I've made in the industry. But I always viewed it as work and not passion. And I've had this desire to do more in different things. So when the company I was working for decided to divest out of the United States and lay us off, I kind of was like, great.
A gift.
A gift, a happy gift. You know, people are like, what are you going to do? I'm like, nothing related to this. I'm going to do other things. So, and it makes it sound like I was unhappy. I wasn't. I had done it for a long time and I was ready to move on. So it's a pretty incredible feeling now to just like, for example, be sitting here with you, talking to you about something that brings, like, jazzes me and, you know, fills my, kind of makes my soul sing, I guess I would say.
Yes. Well, I think what's an important aspect that we're going to be talking about today, and I think it's very, very important, is dyslexia. Because you were diagnosed with dyslexia when you were 6 years old. I think you were probably born with it, but it wasn't diagnosed until you were in the first grade. And I'd like to talk about this because we're going to definitely be talking about Rudy. I mean, we can't not talk about Rudy. He's a focus here. But I thought what we could do is let's start off with some definitions because I think definitions are important. So can you explain what dyslexia is and how it manifested in your life?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of people really don't know. Maybe they've heard the word thrown around, but they don't know what's involved in it. So dyslexia is actually the most common learning disability in the country. It's estimated that around 40 million adults are afflicted with dyslexia, but meanwhile, only 3 million people have actually been diagnosed. So you've got a whole bunch of people, you know, out there who are struggling in their own ways and not sure why they're struggling. Dyslexia is a, like I said, a learning disability that affects skills involved in reading, spelling, and writing. And this is why lots of times when kids are diagnosed, they can be diagnosed very early, like, you know, first, second, third grade, because it will show up once they're in school. So one thing that's key with dyslexia is that early diagnosis and intervention provide kids with the best outcome. That said, even if you get that, I had early intervention, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that looked like, but there's still challenges. Dyslexia, there is no cure for it. It's more when you've had some intervention, there's you learn kind of how to manage it, and it becomes muted, I guess, is how I would describe it. However, there are some challenges that still exist that are difficult to overcome, and one for me, for example, was just poor hand-eye coordination. Anything involving, me having to catch something or hit like a ball, so baseball or tennis or golf, was just really difficult for me. I don't see the ball the way, or I should say I didn't see the ball the way that I do, the way other people do to be able to connect with it. Also, interestingly, dyslexia runs in families. So, for example, my family
really?
Is dyslexic. Yeah, and so you'll see whole family that might have dyslexia. And my dad was born with it too, but never got diagnosed and didn't discover he had it until I was actually diagnosed. And then he figured out that he had dyslexia.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting in that way. And also there's a preference, dyslexia runs in men more than women, about 60% of dyslexia are men. So these are some things that maybe people didn't know about or don't know about it. I guess I think it's important to say that dyslexics have normal intelligence. Just they'll have challenges, like I said, lots of times reading, be slow readers, or take longer to really kind of internalize and absorb things, but they have normal intelligence. And from a vision, people sometimes assume that, let's say, if you can't catch a ball, that you have a problem with your vision. But it isn't a problem in the vision. It's a problem with, like, your neural pathways. That's a little bit about dyslexia.
Well, I really appreciate knowing that. You told me things that I was not aware of. And you were 6 years old when you were diagnosed. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. I feel really grateful for it because it having the early intervention, although I will admit that when you're 6 years old and you're just trying to, you know, fit in school, how school is with kids and things, and right off the bat, I'm struggling. And then I get diagnosed, and the teacher recommends to my parents that I, you know, repeat it because she had experienced that would allow me to just become more comfortable and confident. And it would lay a better foundation for the rest of my scholastic career if I was held back. And that was really how she felt about it. And my parents, you know, took kind of her recommendation. They had noticed some early signs, you know, kids start writing even before they're in school. They're holding crayons and things, and they learn to write their name often. And, you know, they had already noticed that one of the kind of the hallmarks is that kids will reverse letters in words. So, like, before intervention, I would spell my name D-A-I-N-E, and did that quite frequently. And to me, that was D-I-A-N-E. But it wasn't.
Interesting.
You know.
Yes. Wow.
And you really, dyslexics think they're like, yeah, that's right. But it's not right.
Must be comforting when you talk to somebody that says, me too, you know? Because I'm wondering, how did this affect you when you were a child?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it definitely affected me. And I think I'll tell you a little bit more about kind of some of the things like signs, because if people are listening, anybody with children, it might help them to say, hey, you know, either I'm that way or my child is this way. And it might help them realize that they should get some, diagnostics to see what's going on. But like little things like, I naturally read right to left, and I guess that's not such a little thing, right? It's completely backwards. So I naturally read right to left. Like I said, I would reverse letters frequently in words. I would, let's say, write a lowercase d, and in my, so for me, a lowercase d actually would be a b, and to me, that was a d. My mom
interesting.
Would be like, oh, backwards.
That's...
So everything kind of was reversed. For me.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, go ahead and ask your question.
Well, because, you know, it's really interesting how many people might be listening to this going, oh my gosh, I never realized that. The same thing happened to me, or my grandson or my granddaughter or whomever is experiencing those same things. And we're going to be talking more about this, but I know that horseback riding became a pretty important part of all of this, didn't it?
Yeah, really surprising. And I'm going to refrain from delving into that piece for the moment.
All right.
Just to kind of finish this thought so that, like you said, I think it's important part of what I want to do by telling my story is to just help raise awareness, right? So we've got 37 million people out there walking around who are dyslexic and have no idea. They may just think they're not as smart as other people, which is absolutely not the case. And even if they didn't get early intervention, when we get talking to what I ended up discovering for myself through horseback riding, they'll learn that they can change their brain if they're 30, 40, 50 years old, your brain still has this amazing neuroplasticity to change and do things that it didn't do, you know, decades before.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about that a little bit. But for me, school was really, certainly early was very difficult. And I, of course, you know, being held back was no fun. And my friends went on. And I, the only saving grace was that I adored my teacher. And the deal was that I would get to have her for a second time. She made a huge difference for me. And then there was the problem of, you know, special ed. And there's a stigma, and kids aren't always so
absolutely
nice about, oh, you know, you're a dummy and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
the bullying.
Yeah, you know, and there nobody talked about that. Now we talk about it, but
certainly
it just kind of ran more rampant back then. And then on the playground, it was like a nightmare because anything, or in PE, anything that required this like higher level of coordination, like kickball or something. And, you know, teachers think, oh, yeah, this is great for kids. It's great if you can kick the ball, but if you can't and you're never kicked and put on the team, it isn't fun.
Man.
In my, you know, early years, I would say, I think the residue for me on that was just not feeling confident and not feeling confident and feeling like I was not as smart as other kids, which did carry and bleed into kind of my overall confidence. Even though I did very well in school going forward, it still was, I never really felt confident. It was always like I was afraid to raise my hand. I did not want to be called on. I mean, I would have rather have died than get up in front and read
crawl under the desk,
report.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. I get that. Yes.
No part of that was fun for me, you know. But, again, with the intervention, it made a big difference, and I was able to kind of have a very normal academic career. And the even things like in special ed, one of the things that we, I call it drilled, but practice, I guess, is a better word, is they would, I'd sometimes go in for 15, 20 minutes, they'd just throw a ball to me, and I'd have to practice catching it, and then I'd have to bounce the basketball, and then they'd put me on a balance beam and make me walk on a balance beam and bounce the basketball, right? And by the end, I could do it all, and that changed my brain and gave me more coordination than some people would actually, you know, have if they had no intervention. So that's some of,
but do you
of
think,
how it looks
do you think,
with a kid.
Do you think that riding a horse also had an enormous effect on your dyslexia?
Well, absolutely. So, you know, one of the, a little earlier you asked me the question about, you know, well, what is dyslexia and how does it manifest itself? And so maybe it would be helpful to talk a little bit about that, you know. So, okay, so I go on and I go through school and I have a career and life is kind of normal, right? But I would say that that hand-eye coordination piece never was good, right? It was my, you know, if somebody tosses me keys, for example, I mean, it's more likely to have the keys hit me off the top of the head than for me to catch the keys. Or, in fact, my boyfriend of 28 years says to me, has said to me many times, and it sounds mean, but it's really not mean. It's just accurate. He's like, guy, you have hands like feet. And I'm like, you know what? That's about right, because my feet would be as useful for catching keys as my hands are. So, you know, I accepted, had to accept from a young, you know, age that I was just not going to be able to play or basketball or, you know, that these sports were just going to be out of reach for me. And it was okay because there's plenty of things to do without those things. And I, you know, just started really excelling more in things like I raced triathlons for a decade, and I love hiking because hiking is, you know, out in nature. So that was wonderful. And just would do things. When I was a kid, I used to figure skate. So I would do things that didn't involve that level of kind of hand-eye coordination. And it wasn't until honestly, the last, well, 5 years, that I found a difference in this hand-eye coordination completely by accident, and I know it's attributed to writing. So it's been a very, I will say, stunning and interesting journey to realize the change
sure.
that writing made for me.
You and I had spoke, you know, before we were on the air together, and you were telling me about hippotherapy, and that was a term I had never heard of before. It's not hypnotherapy; it's hippotherapy, correct? Like H-I-P-P-O, hippotherapy. Am
yes.
I spelling that correctly?
I had never
heard of hippotherapy. Could you tell us just briefly what that is?
Yeah, sure. I actually have the official definition
because
I don't want to misrepresent it in any way. But what hippotherapy is a form of physical, occupational, and speech therapy in which you have a therapist who would work with, let's just say, a child, right? A child with a horse. And you also have someone who is handling the horse. So you've got, you know, two adults, one working with the child, let's say, and one working with the horse, and you put them together. And what they do is they carefully design different motor and sensory input for the child to experience on the back of the horse. And what they found is that that the act of just being on a horse is very therapeutic and affects the brain, actually changes the brain. So, for example, kids with autism, kids with cerebral palsy, adults too, anybody really. So whether it's autism, cerebral palsy, multiple sclerosis, head injuries, sometimes in the case of spinal cord injuries, where you've got somebody who's, you know, paralyzed, they have, there's instances of people using hippotherapy to actually regain the use of their legs again, which is,
oh my God.
And I don't want to say that that happens every time, but there are, it's more than, you know, just one person. Multiple people have had that experience, and same like, let's say a stroke victim could have, they've lost one, you know, movement on one side of their body, but by putting them on a horse and then having someone who carefully maps out how they're going to move the horse, what happens is it like simulates, your brain thinks you're actually doing the movement, like that you're walking, for example, feels the walking, and it, like I said, can repair your neural pathways. So that's a little bit about hippotherapy. It's pretty interesting, and as I've been poking around and looking for outlets for my story, because I think it's stunning that at middle age that my brain could change and have such a startling effect on impact on my life, which we'll talk about in a minute, but as I've been looking for these outlets, what I have found by talking to people who research dyslexia, that there's not a lot of talk about using hippotherapy for dyslexia, and yet I am living proof that it absolutely works.
Isn't that, wow, if for no other reason, every single person listening to this right now if they're a school teacher, they're that parent, grandparent, person that is suffering. Maybe we don't use the word suffering, but experiencing. I think I'd like to use that word differently. Experiencing what you just said, and who would have ever recognized the value of being on a horse? And you liked horses anyway as a small child, correct?
Yeah, I did, and that actually kind of, maybe there's a piece to fill in kind of the story, which is, yes, I was born loving all animals. I mean, I am I am the person that, even as an adult, I save the earthworms off the pavement so they don't die when things dry up, you know. So, like, I am very tuned in and love all animals and creatures.
Mm-hmm.
But horses kind of really stole my heart young. That ornery little pony, you know, I'm like, oh, my God, I must have one of these myself.
Yeah,
exactly. But my family just wasn't in the cards, and I had promised myself that one day I would own a horse because I just love them, and I'm like, this is going to come to fruition. But what I can tell you is that, as we all know, life, you know, has its own plan sometimes. And
sure.
And basically, once I got into the financial services industry, and as I kind of advanced and my roles changed, I got into a sales role that required travel and a lot of travel. And I did that for, you know, I don't even know, 17 years or something of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're commuting 3 to 4 hours a day into Boston to be in an office, and then when you're not doing that, you're on a plane and you're not around at all, there's no time
mm-hmm.
for owning a horse.
Right.
Or even horseback riding. So I constantly was just like, my gosh, like, how can I have more horse time in my life? And especially as I was getting older, I'm like, I can't believe I've gotten this far. And I still, you know, I would plug it in wherever I could. So I would go to, let's say, a ranch and ride for a week in Colorado, or sometimes,
mm-hmm.
you know, a stable would open up nearby, and people have a way of kind of, they seem to come and they go. And so I would end up riding there for a while till they closed or things changed and maybe wasn't so desirable to go. But so I'd plug
mm-hmm.
them in wherever I could, but I still wasn't getting this horse time that I wanted. And,
right.
But 11 years ago, I made a decision to start working at a new company. There was nothing wrong with the old company. I'd worked there for 13 years. They were wonderful, but this new opportunity presented itself. And part of the attraction was that they didn't require me to go into the office. They just said, as long as you do your job and get on a plane and visit your clients as is required, you can work anywhere you want. And that gave me my first case of some work-life balance in my adult life. And I actually
sure.
now had a crack of, you know, like I said, you know, opening. And so that first year that I started that job, I made a New Year's resolution that I was going to start taking horseback riding lessons. And, well, if anybody who knows me knows this is a trait of mine, when I make some promise to you or to me, I keep it. So, of course, then it's January, and I'm like, well, darn, now I got to find some place to go ride, and it's January. But I did that, and this is where I met my amazing horse, Rudy. So
mm-hmm.
that puts Rudy in the picture. At the age of 50, I made my lifelong dream of horse ownership come true.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I had absolutely no idea what I was getting into. The fact that I had ridden with some, I mean, honestly, I was clueless. I mean, I think I was literally as clueless as new parents would say they're clueless about when they have a child. You know,
mm-hmm.
you think you have got some idea, but then the reality is not that. You know, you're like, oh, my gosh, I did not expect it to be like this. And I will tell you that taking Fina Thoroughbred, who hadn't been worked with for a number of years, who is headstrong like Rudy is, he has opinion about everything. I mean, like, oh my gosh, it's been a journey, but amazing. Honestly, the biggest joy and challenge of my life, but he gives me so much, and he's kind of saying, once I said yes to that job and then started saying, you know, said yes and got horse, you know, riding, and then things opened up with Rudy, and all of a sudden his situation became in flux, so I was presented with the opportunity to buy him and decided to. You know, it's like it was a series of yeses, and I'm actually working on a piece right now, a story called The Power of Yes, because to me, yes, when you're not stepping outside of your, like, comfort zone, well, not that, like, you can step outside your comfort zone, but when you're not stretching yourself and kind of abusing yourself by saying yes, in other words, taking on too much when you really can't handle it, but if
right.
you say yes and say to new things, it opens a flow of energy, and then really cool things can come into your life. And the last 10 years of my life have been the best 10 years of my life, which mm-hmm. I don't know that everybody says when they're, you know, in their 50s.
That's true. And, you know, you mentioned the power of yes. I was going to ask you, you're going to be published in Equilibrium. Is that where the power of yes is going to be? Is that where that's going to be published?
That no, actually, but thanks for asking.
So tell
that,
us about tell us about Equilibrium, because I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, so Equilibrium is a magazine that's published by the National Hippotherapy Association.
Oh.
So this is an association that caters to all the therapists that would be involved in hippotherapy. So think occupational therapists, physical therapists, social workers, psychologists, and there's more. But any therapist who mm-hmm. might be involved in working with a human and in conjunction with a horse, a lot of them are part of this association. And then Equilibrium publishes a magazine twice annually. And so I approached them with my story and said, hey, I think my story is pretty cool. Would you
mm-hmm.
publish it?
Yes.
So
that's cool.
That's exciting. Yeah. It's just, and you being willing to talk to me and get my story out there is wonderful too. So thank you so much for just taking the time and for having interest in it.
I do, and I would like people to know that, and I mean, this will be, I will have this posted for people so they don't have to take notes while they're listening to this, but you have a wonderful website, Rudy the Roodster. I'm going to spell this, R-U-D-Y, the, T-H-E, Roodster, but it's spelled R-U-D-S-T-E-R.com. And there on that website are the Adventures of Rudy the Roodster, these three books. And, you know, I'm looking at your website right now, and I think I made a mistake in thinking something. Were all three of these books, did they all receive this acclaim for the Moonbeam?
Yeah,
or was it just the last one?
No,
all
yeah,
three.
Yeah, so the award actually is for best, it was a bronze award from Moonbeam, and they won the award for best children's book series nonfiction, which just is honestly thrilling for me. So that happened last November, and, you know, kind of like, gratifying, because I thought I had a cool story to put there. And I know Rudy knows he has a cool story, so, you know.
that's great. Well, I'm glad I noticed that, because I think that I wasn't clear about that, and I'll make sure that I clarify that all three books were awarded this Moonbeam Award. And I know you've written Rudy the Big Horse with a Big Heart, Rudy Trailers, Pigs, and New Friends, and Rudy Change Can Be Good. So what prompted if I understand this correctly, this book is written in first person Rudy, am I right? Rudy's writing the book.
Oh yes, Rudy is
writing it.
I have a question for me. You tell me where you'd like to go. I'm happy to start talking about Rudy and the books, but I think there's maybe a missing piece. People will be like, okay, that she said that writing helped her dyslexia, but really how and how did you how did you find it? So would it be helpful for me to maybe take a little step back?
I say this, Diane, because people can go to the website and they can see all of these books, and we can talk about the books. But I think what I'm hearing from you, and I think is really important, and I think that this is what I'm hearing, is that, yes, you've written these fabulous books and all of that. I don't want to undermine that that's important. But I think this is an education. And I think the more that you want to talk about dyslexia and what that means, if you feel like you there's more that you'd like to say about this, I really want to encourage you to do so.
Yeah, well, thank you. And there is, because I think if I describe a little bit about kind of how this came about, people will have maybe a better just idea of how it works. And, you know, effectively, again, I'm just this middle-aged person going through life. Now I've got a horse, and of course, I'm riding. And actually, the first 4 years with Rudy were difficult in the sense that it was tough to find a barn that fit us well, really fit him well. Again, he's thoroughbreds and known for being kind of high maintenance, being very sensitive, and they can, and change often throws them off. And unfortunately, when horses have a lot of change in their life, let's say a herd, like the herd they're going out with people, you know, take their horses and move somewhere else or introduce new horses. Every time the whole thing has to be rejiggered and there's squabbles. And so it introduces a lot of chaos into the way we keep horses, can introduce a lot of chaos into their lives and cause a lot of stress. And Rudy is a horse who is, because he's sensitive and he gets anxious, he's a high-stress horse, and he ends up getting ulcers and things like that. So I was on a hunt for a barn, and I ended up finding one in 2019, and it's a wonderful barn. The name of it is Five Stars Farm, and I moved Rudy there, and this is when I started riding dressage. And I know when you and I did our prep call, you were like, what is dressage?
Correct.
For people who don't know what dressage is a French term. It commonly means training. But in this context, it's defined as the highest expression of horse training, where a horse and a rider are expected to perform from memory both a series of predetermined movements. And many of the cues that riders give these horses are really nearly imperceptible. You need to have a trained eye to be able to tell what they're doing. So in some respects, it's very cool to watch because you're like, you can't tell that the rider is affecting all that's going on. You see virtually no movement in the rider, and yet this horse is doing all these incredible things. So it's pretty cool. The owner of the barn that Rudy is at now, we've been there for 5 years, actually it'll be 5 years in April, is owned by a woman who is a gold medalist at the Pan American Games, who competed successfully in numerous international competitions in Europe and the U.S., and she was also shortlisted for the U.S. Olympic dressage team back in the 80s. So this is somebody who knows dressage and knows it well, and I started training under her. Rudy and I started training regularly, and you know, again, I'm just doing this thing, and I don't know if anything is going on. I would describe it to people, my friends and family and stuff, like that. I would say it's rub your stomach, pat your head on steroids, and so if you're challenged with that, then you're really going to be challenged with dressage. And then throw in a dyslexic. So you ride this dressage, it is this constant interplay between your left side and your right side. And then you combine that with riding the horse in patterns. So you'll ride it, let's say, in a circle. Then you'll ride it in a serpentine or maybe like a teardrop. And then you start changing gaits. So you might go from a walk to a trot and then a trot to a canter and back. But keep in mind that whole time, again, it's this whole left-right thing. And I will admit, when I started, there were days where I was just like, oh, my gosh, what are you talking about? Like, she would be giving me verbal instructions, and my brain was just like exploding, you know. I'm like,
sure.
No, I can't.
It's a lot to take in.
About.
Yes.
Yeah. While you're riding a horse. And she was always really great about just, she'd be like, come on over here and get out the little whiteboard, and would draw the pattern for me. And when I could see it, I would be like, ah, oh, I got you now. Like, now I got it.
Mm-hmm.
So now I've got it in my brain. I could see the pattern. And then she would orally tell me again. And so over time, as I've ridden, you know, under her for now 5 years, I've gotten better and improved. And I'm just sitting there going, oh, well, this is wonderful, right? It's great that I'm progressing. But I never really dreamed that it was doing anything, like I said, anything that is changing my brain. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I go and take a vacation in June of 22 and rent a vacation home. And it has a tennis court. And my boyfriend, who does not have dyslexia, you know, we had tried to play tennis years ago, and it was a disaster. And it really an exercise in frustration for both of us. And so here we are with this nice vacation home that's got a pool and a tennis court. He says to me on the second day, do you want to go and hit the ball around? And I'm like, no, I can't hit the ball. It's not fun. And he's like, oh, just come out. You know, let's just go do it. And he lobs the ball over the net to me, and I connect with the ball.
Oh, man.
I mean, I have to tell you,
you're
I'm
shocked.
Completely stunned. But
yeah.
I also think it's a complete fluke, right? So I was like, well, that was lucky. So he hits it back to me, and I hit it again. And we proceed to go back and forth, and I can see the ball now. And I play tennis. We play tennis regularly. We've kept playing tennis ever since we rented that place, and to the point of me even playing on public courts, because I was convinced. I'm like, no, I really do still stink at this. And my brother kept going, I played with him one time, and he's like, you're not bad guy. He's like, you're actually better than a lot of people I see. And I'm like, that cannot be. I have never been good at this kind of stuff in my life, you know? And I will tell you that still, every time I get a chance to go on a tennis court and play, for one, I love it. It's been such an incredible gift to have something brand, like new in your 50s, you know? Well, I guess I've had two things, right? A horse, all kinds of new things in my 50s. But it's like it's like somebody's inhabiting my body. That's how it feels to me. It's so every time I get on a court and I play tennis, it's just like miraculous to me. And so again, this is part of why, you know, it's the message is, like you said in the intro, one of really hope, because there's a lot of things people, I think, especially as they age, there's all this talk about kind of doing less, right? I call it aging out, right? Well, now, as you get older, oh, well, you're not going to be able to run anymore, and you're not going to be able to bike anymore, and you're not going to, you know, it's that slow stripping away that society tells you it has to be the norm. And then it's also that, and cognitively, that's going to decline too, right? There's not a lot of good messages out there for people who are in their middle age and beyond. But I am, you know, proof that my 57-year-old brain, like, all of a sudden has been rewired as a result of riding Rudy, doing dressage with Rudy, and now I play tennis, and I can catch balls. Somebody throw me the keys, and I can catch them now. So that's super fun for me.
That must be hard to put into words, because I know that Rudy is writing these books first person. You're writing the book, obviously. Writing.
Yeah.
Not writing, but writing the book.
Yes.
But you know, it's kind of a combo there, I suppose. But I've never been around horses. You know, I live in the city. I mean, I don't know people that have horses. I guess there might be stables or someplace, you know, that you'd have to go out to. It's not like there's no such thing as a horse in California, but or Los Angeles.
You guys have a lot of them out there.
But I'm looking at the pictures, the jackets of your books, and I'm looking into the face in that first book where Rudy's just looking straight at me. And it's like you can almost, in fact, it says a big horse with a big heart. You can almost, I can almost feel the love. I can almost feel the emotion of that horse looking at me. It's a beautiful picture. It really is. And I think for many people that, you know, have grown up in the city and didn't know anything about this, I have a friend that is a kindergarten teacher, and I can assure you I'm going to be talking to her about this because maybe she recognizes some of these same symptoms in her own students. And maybe a teacher sometimes points these things out even before the parent realizes it. But I think that what you've done with these adventures of Rudy is just phenomenal. And they're all available. When people go to your website, they will certainly see that. Has there been something but writing these books that provided you with something that was an unexpected gift that you just went, wow, I didn't see that coming?
Well, yes, definitely. That's a great question. I had no intention. So I did have on my bucket list write a book, but I had no intention of writing a book. That was not on the list anywhere. But once, and I am going to answer your question, but once Rudy entered my life, I would say about 2 years into owning Rudy, I just really got struck with the similarities that what I knew of his life and how he had lived, the similarities of his life and similarities that I had gone through, and the common denominator was no control. The common denominator was, you know, me, like, horses don't typically have any, right? They have no control. They can't talk to us, and they can't tell us what they like and what they don't like. They can show us, and when you get good at horses, you learn how to recognize them.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, they get kind of jostled around, and they have different owners, and they move to different barns, and their herds constantly change, and they have no control over their, you know, their feeding schedule, and they just have to try to adapt, right, and adjust to our environment. And that is very similar to a lot of children, right? When you're kids, the adults make all the decisions, and there's good reason why, you know, whether it's, you know, but then there's a bunch of stuff that happens to kids that they don't, you know, it isn't great. So divorce, for instance, got divorced at six, when I was 6 years old, and I certainly never wanted to see that happen, or, you know, a family moves, but, you know, because they need to find work, or somebody starts dating, you know, mom or dad starts dating. So there's all these things that children, as they grow up, have to deal with, just have to do their best to kind of adapt. And this was a similarity that all of a sudden just, like, it became like this neon screaming sign to me. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, Rudy, I can use Rudy to connect with kids and help them. And if Rudy tells a story, Rudy can talk all about his feelings, about everything, and that will allow kids to really fall in love with him, connect with him, and then not feel as alone, know that there's another being out there that might feel scared and might feel, you know, angry and might feel sad. And so really my, you know, goal initially around writing these books was to really connect with children, and subsequently I've had so many gifts from this. Turns out Rudy absolutely loves children, and every time I bring him one or I set up a play date, as I call them, he is just amazing. He is attentive and sweet and will hang out with a child as long as they want. And often when the child, you know, the mom, and lots of times it's grandparents love my books, and, you know, they love the hardcover book you can hold in their hand. And so they've been great customers for me. And often it's a grandmother, you know, with a mother and a child who will approach me and say, hey, can we come for a visit? And I can't accommodate all of the requests, but some, of course, I do. And Rudy just loves it. So one of my gifts is just, I never had children. It's been wonderful to kind of pull children into my life in this way. And then, like I said, it turns out that Rudy just, I mean, he loves the interaction with kids. I've seen him literally go, like with my niece when she was young, he would go hours and playing with her. He would not eat his food. He wouldn't go and get a drink. He would ignore all the other horses, and he just would stay with her.
Wow.
So, you know, I don't know. I feel like all of this was supposed to happen this way from the moment I conceived of this book. The words just kind of started writing themselves in my head, like whole paragraphs would just kind of get dumped into my brain, and I would have to just go home and just write and write and write. And basically, you know, it just all along, I'm like, this is going to be a 3-book series. They're going to be hardcovered. They're going to have stunning art. I want Rudy to look like Rudy. And I want parents to be like, wow, these books are really high quality, cool books.
Mm-hmm.
One, they help, you know, connect with children. And they're also, because Rudy tells the story, he can educate kids about all things horse. So he can talk about how horses,
right.
You know, humans love trail rides. They think that they're a whole lot of fun. Well, Rudy doesn't think trail rides are so fun because they're actually scary, right? There's all these things. He's in an environment and little animals dart around and spook him, and big rocks look like, you know, a scary lion, you know. And so he is able to tell kids like how a horse thinks and feels and relates to the world. And so what happens is they learn a lot as they read the stories. And then every book is made complete with a whole equine glossary, 20 fun horse facts.
Nice.
Each book has different horse facts. So you get like 60 fun horse facts. And then I do tack diagrams and horse anatomy. So they're great learning books. And that was kind of another goal, which was to help educate people about horses so that more people kind of can help horses. We've got a whole lot of horses in this country, and a lot of them are in really bad situations. So I'm passionate about trying to help our horses. They're amazing.
Because I don't know, so if you don't know, that's why you ask questions. What is a normal life of a horse? Do horses live decades and decades? I don't know.
Yeah, everybody's always shocked. So you're not the only one. First of all, most people don't know that horses have been on the planet for 50 million years.
Wow.
That is a long time.
You're right
time.
About that.
Animals they've got some staying power. And everybody's shocked to learn that most horses, especially if they are in a good environment where they get high quality veterinary care and other types of care, can live 30 years. And people are shocked. But one thing you have to remember is horses are prey animals, and they live in herds, and their family, that herd, is extremely important. And once you choose a horse, right, you effectively force them into your herd. If you go and let them go for some reason, right, which many people do, you know, maybe they outgrow the horse, they need a horse that can take them to a higher level of their goals or what have you, or even they just can't afford them anymore, but it's hard on the horses. All those, like, changes, you know. So a day in the life of a horse, it really varies. You know, ideally horses would be in a herd in a huge field so they can interact naturally, they can move. That's critical for them to be as healthy as possible, both for their hooves and their digestion. But often this is not the case for horses, right? They're kept in, you know, at smaller stables, they're kept in small individual paddock, so maybe they can have interaction over a fence. It's not ideal, but it's often what our own choices.
And
then they spend way more time in a stall than they should, you know. So, and that includes Rudy, unfortunately. But the flip side is the barn is wonderful in terms of IT. It's like Switzerland. Everything runs on schedule and time. I love it. And so does he. So
yeah, that's nice.
Does
Rudy have siblings? Is that the term? I mean, were there other?
I have no idea. I don't know, because he came into my life when I met him when he was nine, and he's a thoroughbred. Like I said, he was born in Saratoga at a racing barn, but he never was, as I like to say, he had more woe than go. And so even though he can be a little spooky and flighty, he's not like a horse that wants to run fast. Like, kind of, he'll take a few quick steps and then he's like, oh, she's having a lot of work, you know?
he's oh, like, man.
You know, and looks at you like, do I really have to, you know, do that or whatever? So I don't know if he had siblings. I just knew there was his breeder loved his personality and held on to him for as long as she really felt she could, which, like I said, was about 9 years. And then she sold him to someone else, to a family with a teenage girl. But he's a lot of horse for somebody who's younger. And, so that didn't work out that well. And that's kind of when I came into the picture and observed Rudy really displaying a lot of signs that he was emotionally unhappy and things not working out for him. And so I kind of decided that I didn't want anything bad to happen to him and and took the plunge. So here we are.
It was meant to be, right? It was meant to be. So as you're looking, this is the first part of the year. As you look forward into this year, are you thinking about writing a book 4? Is that in the future for you?
I truthfully am not. It doesn't mean I won't. So, like I said, my vision for this series was always quite clear. It was 3 books. I completed the 3rd book in the end of 2022. I've been focusing on really marketing and growing distribution, getting it into schools and libraries.
Sure.
Which is a job, let me tell you. And so I'm busy with that. And in the meantime, you know, one of the gifts, you asked me about gifts, has really been just coming back to writing. I always liked writing as a child. It was one of the things that gave me a voice and an outlet. And I actually even won a writing contest at one point. And I was like, oh, maybe this is halfway decent at. So writing has always been like a little safe haven for me, and it's just been amazing to come back to that. So I'm working on writing other things. I submitted a story to Chicken Soup for the Soul that I'm hoping they'll love and publish this year, and working on some other things for outlets for stories that I have, like I said, like The Power of Yes.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I could see you being on the local TV news. Have you ever been on the local news where you live?
You know, I have no, and I want to be. There's this wonderful show called The Chronicle, and I think my story, Rudy's story, like our collective story, is an amazing story to share locally. And I've reached out to them and so far have been unsuccessful in getting them to do that. But, you know, perseverance is like my middle name, so I won't forget. I might leave for a little while, but I always come back.
I sense that about you. I don't see any limitations in what you do. I could see a documentary. I could see all kinds of different things. I could see you being at libraries and having readings. I could see you at all kinds of schools and, you know, meetings. And I just want to thank you for sharing so much of what was very personal for you, because we just never know, Diane, we just never know when someone is listening to a story how they are affected by that. And perhaps somebody listening to this story is going to say, Wow, I never would have realized that. This is something I want to know more about. They can go to your website. They can contact you directly. You're available. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you for sharing such an inspiring story about your life and your Rudy. It's been just delightful.
Well, thank you so much, Marcia. It has been an absolute joy. And like I said, thank you for recognizing the story and having me on. And to any listeners, you know, if you get out onto my website and you have questions, there's a way to contact me. So you can always contact me through the website. And the books are all available on Amazon as well, in addition to the website.
Right. They're on your website as well. So I just, what a wonderful way to end this month in March and to share it with somebody that is so inspiring, Diane. I am so glad that we met and that you were able to share this. And trust me, I will be seeing my friend that teaches kindergarten in a couple of days, and I will definitely be talking to her about your book because she may be able to relate to this. So for all of you listening, think about that. Think about who you know in your family or friends and see about how you can help them find the Rudy in their lives. So I'm going to say goodbye to you for now in New Hampshire. Have a lovely rest of your evening. And I look forward to being here next month when I begin my 9th year of doing the Born to Talk radio show. Whoever would have thought it. Thank you. Thank you. It's remarkable. All right, everybody. So have a great rest of your day. I'm going to let Diane get on with hers. Bye for now, everyone.
I recently bought a new electric BMW iX from Sterling BMW. It's simply the best car I've ever driven. Sterling BMW is family-owned for over 30 years, and they treat you, well, like family. Sterling BMW is certainly worth the drive to Newport Beach. I made it. Plenty of vehicles to choose from, and exceptional offers from BMW Financial Services. So visit sterlingbmw.com, sterlingbmw.com.
We mark every inch that our kids grow.
Whoa, look how tall you're getting.
And watch them outgrow. Well, everything.
This shirt is way too small.
But there's something else that can grow that we don't see. It's what doctors call toxic stress. It's how a child's body responds to difficult experiences, from harsh language to a painful loss. There are steps parents can take to help. Learn 4 things you can do to overcome toxic stress at firstfivecalifornia.com.